This is PJ Souls, and you are listening to The Bloody Pit. Have a great day, and don't forget to gabba gabba hey, 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 hey ho, let's go.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of The Bloody Pit. We step outside the realm of what I would normally cover in a show called, well, The Bloody Pit, to venture into, well, in a lot of ways it's a nice area for me because it's the 1970s. But I have a new guest host, someone that you've not heard from before, but if I'm very lucky, you'll hear from more often in the future. This is another friend of mine, and if we can survive the night with his cat attacking everything inside, including me, we will bring you a show about, one of your favorite movies?
It is one of my favorite movies. And have you ever done a podcast without a cat attack at some point?
I used to do nothing but podcasts without cat attacks. These days, it's just not all that possible, no matter where I go. But, either my new house, where I have a cat that will attack, and at Troy's, we always have Flex, who at least make his presence known by weighing down whatever large object he needs to sit on and crush.
Flex is a big guy.
Yeah, Flex is a big guy. But at any rate, let me introduce my co-host for this. My name is Rod Barnett, and with me tonight is John Hudson, a man I've known for a number of years, but not been able to get to know as well as I would like, mainly because he appears to hate me.
That's true, actually. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But for my 15 seconds of fame, I'm here tonight.
If this is your
15 seconds.
15 seconds, yeah. You're not going to get 15 minutes out of a podcast, let me tell you right now.
15 seconds, maybe. No, it's a pleasure. I love your show, and I'm actually very happy to be doing this. This is going to be fun.
When you came up with this idea, I thought it was a great one, and I have to admit, I was a little surprised it just came out of left field for me. But I cannot honestly remember how long I've known you.
Probably 10 years, more than that, maybe about 12.
Probably
right around 2000, I think.
I would have to say we probably met through mutual friends. Top of the list would be my NashyCast co-host, Troy Gwynn, who I'm sure I know knew you before I did.
Just a bit, yeah. The story is that our friend Jack, who I know you've mentioned from time to time, I'd known him for years, but kind of fallen out of touch with them. And there was a girl that I was seeing who mentioned to me, oh, you should come see my Celtic band play Saturday night. So I go to see your Celtic band. I walk in, and there's Jack on lead vocals. So that came out of nowhere, and that sort of introduced me to that whole circle, and you were part of that circle. So it was...
Yeah, I was probably a drunken dancing fool part of that circle.
I think so. The time I started to hate you was that.
Anyone having that much fun in public is...
No fun.
Well, here in the, I guess we should say we live in the greater Nashville area, and that's about as specific as I want to get. So a Celtic band in Nashville is just like any other band in Nashville. There's a dozen of them. So.
Right. You're exactly right.
But nowadays, you are actually in a band with Troy that isn't a Celtic band. You're in the Exotic Ones, which what would you call it, a monster rock and roll guitar band?
We get called psychobilly, and I don't know if that's entirely fair. It's sort of 60s-ish inspired garage-ish rock, but we're hard to pigeonhole because we'll do a Kiss cover followed by a country song that we wrote, followed by a song about vampires having drag races.
Which, actually, there aren't nearly enough songs about vampires and drag races.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But, the one thing all of our songs have in common, none of them are too serious. We try to have a good time, and that's really what it's about. You know, our music is fun without being overly silly, well, usually.
Usually. Well, that's the Exotic Ones, and you guys have had a CD out for a while, and I'll tell you what, this show's going to be packed with Ramones music, but I may just throw an Exotic Ones tune at the end of it just to have fun. What's funny is I just remembered you guys, for years, did that great mashup of Porter Wagner's song Rubber Room
with Psychotherapy.
With Psychotherapy by the Ramones, which is just one of the greatest combinations I ever heard in my life.
But we did it, and we did it beautifully.
It was wonderful.
It was beautiful. And we still do She's the One by the Ramones. We'll put that in the set every often. And I've been known to sing Time Bomb by the Ramones from time to time because it's in my range. Dee Dee's range and mine are pretty similar. Take that with what you will.
Yeah, take that with whatever. So that is John Hudson, a man of many talents and much pop culture knowledge. And I am me. What we're going to do is we will get down to a discussion of, this is the first time I've done a long-term discussion of, let's just say, a comedy in English, ever. So this will be interesting. We're going to be covering Rock and Roll High School from 1979, a movie that I had not seen in well over 20 years until just recently. And I think it's going to be fun. So if you're a Ramones fan, You're a Alan Arkush fan. I don't know. How many Alan Arkush fans are there out there?
There should be more.
There should be more.
There should be more. If you're a Paul Bartel fan, a Mary Warnoff fan.
PJ Souls.
PJ Souls, Dae Young, Joe Dante, even his fans. There's something for everybody in this movie. There
exactly.
really is.
Well, all right. What we're going to do is we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll discuss why you should see Rock and Roll High School. Rock and Roll High School, 1979, a Roger Corman joint.
And the world needs more of those.
Yes, yes they do. Now, one of the great things about Rock and Roll High School for me is basically it really is just a love letter to the Ramones in a lot of ways. And the funniest thing to me is that, of course, that's not how the movie started out. Roger Corman essentially wanted to get back into, and he wanted to produce another type of film that was similar to some of the films that he produced in the 50s. And so, of course, his idea that he tossed out there was, you know, let's latch on to whatever's hot and in the moment in popular music right now and build a story around it, which is, if you know anything about Corman's production factory, that's kind of how they did it. So here's the thing. How did you discover this film? Because I can tell you how I first saw it, but I have no idea how you first saw this film.
Well, it's an interesting story. Back in the 70s, I was a rabid fan of Sneak Previews, the Siskel and Ebert
show. Oh, the original version on PBS, yeah.
And I was in a spot in Kentucky where I grew up where I could see Sneak Previews on the Evansville, Indiana PBS station, the Nashville, Tennessee PBS station, and the Bowling Green, Kentucky PBS station. So if there was a really interesting episode of Sneak Previews or a clip I really enjoyed, I could see it three or more times.
Good Lord.
So one, for instance, the Dawn of the Dead episode where they reviewed Dawn of the Dead, I must have watched that. Every time it ran, I was in front of the TV just for the precious 45 seconds of Dawn of the Dead that you got to see. But they did a special on cult films and sort of a history of midnight movies and the usual suspects were there. They had clips from Rocky Horror, Night of the Living Dead, Pink Flamingos, which they both hated, as I remember. But at the end of the show, they were saying, now, what's a cult film of the future that we think might catch on as a cult movie? And their pick, or at least one of them's pick, was Rock and Roll High School. And they showed the clip where the Ramones are driving down the street playing Just Want to Have Something to Do while everybody's waiting in the ticket line.
Right.
And I'd heard the Ramones before on the Dr. Demento show. That was the only radio airplay that they were ever going to get where I was. But Dr. Demento would occasionally play Pinhead or Teenage Lobotomy and songs that were a little on the sillier side.
Right.
So, but this was, I think, the first time I'd actually seen the Ramones. And that clip of them driving down the street and Joey throws the chicken leg over his shoulder absolutely blew me out of my socks. And that was an episode of Sneak Previews I watched every time it was on after that because I wanted to see that again. So never got a chance to see it in a theater. It definitely wasn't going to play at Central City, Kentucky at our theater.
Yeah.
But when it came out on home video, or I guess actually it may have already been out, but in the early 80s, my parents got a Betamax, and not long after that, I got a Betamax for myself that I could take off to college because you can't go to college without a Betamax. You know? So
I think there may have actually been legislation to that effect.
There was in my house. So one of the first things I did back in those pre-Macrovision days was rent movies and dub copies.
Yeah.
And the first two movies that I rented were The Who, Farewell Tour in Toronto, because I'd just seen that tour, and Rock and Roll High School. And the summer after I did that was the last summer before I was going to go to college. And my little brother and I must have watched Rock and Roll High School at least 75 to 100 times, sometimes two or three times a day, because we lived in rural Kentucky. There was no cable. You know, if you had a movie, you watched it, and that was the only movie we had. So we watched it a lot. And not only because it was the only one we had, but we loved it. And it was a movie you could see something new in every time you watched. The songs were great. The performances were great. Everything about it's great. There's a million things going on, and I never got tired of it. And still I'm not tired of it. I don't know if I could watch it 75 times in a three-month period now, but...
Well, now you don't have to.
I don't have to. That's right. It's always there.
Well, I probably have only seen Rock and Roll High School in my entire life, probably only three times. And that's just because by the time I saw it, it was on pay cable.
Mm-hmm.
Which means I was seeing it on, it probably had to be Cinemax. So when I saw it, it was uncut at least. To me, I was already a Ramones fan. I had been a Ramones fan for years before I saw the film. And so to me, it was like, oh, well, that's kind of neat. And what was funny is it wasn't until just, you know, years after the fact that I thought, wow, maybe the movie is kind of what made the Ramones a bit more famous. Because it just, I didn't put two and two together or even think mm-hmm. about it. Because at that point in time, the Ramones to me was a band with, you know, multiple albums. So, of course, the mm-hmm. Ramones are famous. Of course they are. Of course. What else? So I can't, I enjoyed the film and thought it was funny as hell. But the significance of it, as far as the Ramones are concerned, didn't strike me until, you know, years later, even right. after I'd seen the movie, because I was already a Ramones fan when I saw it. It wasn't like this was some big conversion point for me. It was like, I mean, man, I know who the Ramones are.
Yeah, I was a Ramones fan going in, and by the time I actually saw the entire movie, I had a few Ramones records, but
yeah.
that was definitely the first time I'd actually seen them.
Well, that leads me to a question that I wanted to ask, which is, what was the first Ramones album you ever bought?
First Ramones record I ever bought was the Rock and Roll High School soundtrack, which really? I found used somewhere.
Huh.
And, of course, it's got the whole concert from the movie and a few assorted Ramones tracks. After that, I honestly can't remember the first Ramones record that I got. It was probably Rocket to Russia.
Huh.
I know I bought Subterranean Jungle New. As it came out.
That so
was
did
the,
I, yeah.
And that was the first one I had access to, because again, and I'll probably say this a lot, where I grew up, there weren't any Ramone albums to be had. So once I, I wasn't in college at that point, but our friend Randy was.
Yeah.
And a college town means there's record stores. So when I would go visit him, I go to the record stores, and I'm sure I bought Subterranean Jungle there. And then after that, I was picking them up the early ones as best I could whenever I'd find them.
By the way, the friend, our mutual friend Randy is Randy Fox, who has been on a podcast with me before. He, if you've never listened to the NashyCast, the sister podcast to this, dear listener, allow me to encourage you. Randy Fox was our guest. Troy, he joined Troy and I for an episode focusing on the classic Spanish horror film, Horror Express, back about a year ago. Well worth listening to.
Very much.
That's another point of contact between us, Randy Fox, and the whole nine yards.
Very incestuous, this
circle. Yes, yes. So thank God we all keep our clothes on. But
well, most tonight. Of the
time. Most of the time. My first Ramones album was Rocket to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening. I was in high school. As a matter of fact, at this point, I was in boarding school. And that's a tale all its own. But I had started listening to Ramones albums that other guys had. And I desperately wanted... I was like, oh, I gotta get one of my own. So I like did the calculus on which ones I saw in the record store that nobody that I could listen to had. And that's the one. I was like, okay, that's the one I'll get. And so I got Rocket to Russia. It was kind of like, you know, a communal thing where it's like I'm filling in a gap that, you know, the dorm I was living in, we didn't have that one. So I get that one. So Rocket to Russia was my first one. And then from there on, it was just a branching out of, you know, there's the making a cassette of the copies of other albums that you don't have so that you can listen to them one way or another.
And I was going to say that's a great one to start with. But then again, pretty much any Ramones record would be a great place to start at that point. There weren't really any bad ones. And
even the ones that
are sort of lesser Ramones albums like End of the Century or Pleasant Dream. There's still great stuff on them, and they're still very interesting. So I don't think you can't go wrong.
Well, the funny thing to me, as I've already mentioned, is that the original idea and the producers, the people actually making this sucker, actually kind of kept quiet about this to Roger Corman was that what Corman thought would be the good idea would be to make a movie about disco, which was the big thing then and, you know, circa 1978-79. And they very quietly were like, no, that's probably not a good idea. And they switched the idea into turning it into a movie about rock and roll. And you can see the wheels turning in Corman's head. Is like, well, rock and roll was the big thing in the 50s. We want the big new thing now, 20 years later. And the thing is, it's like rock and roll is always going to be something that you can do that with. That's not changed. I mean, you know, you go through strange permutations of what's going to be hyper popular at different points in time. I mean, that's always the way it's going to be. But I think we can always look at this film and thank God that there's no movie called Disco High School.
Well, right. And I think Corman is probably pretty thankful, too, because if he had made Disco High School, it would have bombed. Because, I mean, this is right around the same time that Can't Stop the Music, which featured the biggest stars in disco at the time, the Village People, except for the Bee Gees, who were also in a huge flop, and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yeah.
So Disco High would have tanked no matter what. It would have come out after disco had already started to fade. So it worked out okay for everybody.
Yeah, Alan Arkush and Joe Dante kind of saved his ass by by making this film, essentially.
Although, granted, he wouldn't have lost much money if it had tanked
completely.
No. He still wouldn't be out a lot.
Well, the figure I've seen for the budget for this was around $300,000, which at that time was a fairly typical budget for a Roger Corman production, because there's no way he could lose money through, you know, the way he distributed films at the time. There's absolutely no way to lose money on a film that cost less than $500,000, so he was safe. Which is why so many films got made then by people, because they could produce it. If they could produce it for a low enough cost, he'd let them make it. And that's what happened here. Now, I don't often talk about comedies on any of the podcasts. The NashyCast has kind of forced Troy and I into discussing some comedies. I'll use the air quotes and explain to you listeners that I'm using the air quotes.
Comedies.
And it's not that I don't like comedies. It's that unfortunately there's not to sound like some kind of throwback lunatic, but there came a point in, and I don't know if it's that I got older or the movies got dumber, and it may be a confluence of those two things, or it may just be that I got older and I'm older and more cynical and therefore much harder to please now. I don't know. But most comedies that are produced now in the area of film don't do much for me anymore. Mm-hmm. It's the rare comedy that really floors me in general. I don't go out of my way to see comedies in the first place. So I can watch the Three Stooges all damn day long, but I think things like that kind of get grandfathered in because I saw them as a kid.
Right.
I'm always going to love that. And the occasional comedy comes along that I think is mind-bendingly funny, but in general, I'm not going to worry myself with it. This is the kind of film that I remember loving as a style of comedy from early days, and it's still the kind of comedy that I love in a lot of ways because it's almost scattershot. I mean, it has a plot. You're following a story, but there's so many things draped around it in the form of an amazing collection of character actors and bizarre ideas that although the story is moving forward in kind of fits and starts and at times, the overarching story doesn't get in the way of the funny, and the funny doesn't get in the way of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I really get a kick out of. Now, if I were to sit down, I got to thinking about it. What are my favorite comedies? And when I start thinking immediately about the comedies that I really, really love, they're all older movies.
Same here.
One of my all-time favorite comedies ever is Used Cars. Stars Kurt Russell.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never seen it, allow me to recommend it. Came out around the same time as this film.
Yep, great movie.
Great film. Early Bob Zemeckis, Robert Zemeckis film, before he became this bizarre person who constructs everything in a computer model.
That's right. Back then they had Smiles of Cars.
Smiles of Cars. Oh my God. That Used Cars is one of the funniest films I think I've ever seen in my life. This is that same kind of movie where there's this linear forward progression and characters you actually like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's where we ought to start the discussion of it. We should probably lay out the plot of this thing. If you've never seen Rock and Roll High School, I guess we could lay out a bare bones plot of what this thing is. Main character is played by PJ Souls.
Yes, the adorable PJ Souls.
And if you're a fan of the movie Halloween, the mm-hmm. original Halloween, the good one, yeah, she would be one of the she'd be one of Michael Myers' victims in that film.
She was totally Linda.
Yes.
Totally.
Totally. And she's completely adorable. And what I love about this is that the first place I ever saw her was in Halloween because I saw Halloween, you know, years before I saw this film.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really neat about this is that she seems to have that same effervescent character in both movies. It's not that she's playing the same character. It's just that just seems to kind of be her.
Well, even in Carrie, where she's one of the bad girls. So if you remember in Carrie, she's the girl with the baseball cap. You still love her. And she's supposed to not be a very nice person in that, you know?
Yeah. She's supposed to be a bitch.
And you still can't help it. She's just such a happy, effervescent, nice person. And it comes through. And it really works in this.
Well, I tell you what. Let's do this. I'll read a pretty decent description of the story / plot line of Rock and Roll High School, and then we'll take off from that. Vince Lombardi High School keeps losing principals to nervous breakdowns because of the students' love of rock and roll and their disregard of education. The punitive leader of the students is Riff Randall, who loves the music of the Ramones. Riff Randall is played by PJ Souls. A new principal, the rock music-hating Miss Evelyn Togar, is brought in and promises to put an end to the music craze. When Miss Togar and a group of parents attempt to burn a pile of rock records, the students take over the high school, joined by the Ramones, who are made honorary students. When the police are summoned and demand that the students evacuate the building, they do so, which leads to an explosive finale. And that's pretty fair. And what's great about that is it leaves out enough detail that if that encouraged you to see the movie, there'd still be a lot of things for you to discover in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Riff Randall, played by PJ Souls, is adorable. She's your central character. She's the person whose story you're really following because what she wants to do, she wants to see the Ramones because she's written songs that she wants to give them because she thinks they'd be perfect for the Ramones to record.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd seen this movie when I was 14 or 15, that would have struck me perfect. That would have struck me perfectly, right in the chest. I'd be like, "Yeah, man, you know,
absolutely, your favorite love a band, yeah.
That would have been just amazing." But what kills me is, I love all the characters in this movie.
Oh yeah, there's not a bad one there. And one of the things I think that worked great with the Riff Randall character is, she's the rebel in the school. Yeah. She's the troublemaker, yet at the same time, she never makes trouble. She never really causes problems. The biggest thing that she does until the end of the movie is she plays Ramone's record over the intercom.
Right.
But she's not, you know, vandalizing or causing problems at the school. So she's still a nice person.
Well, I mean, the moment in the movie that I think really sums up best Riff Randall is the moment where she's waited for 3 days in line to get tickets to a Ramones concert,
mm-hmm.
and she buys a ton of them.
100 of your best Ramones tickets.
Yes. And then she gives them out to her friends. Mm-hmm. She just hands them out. That's just wonderful. And she does it with this big smile on her face, mm-hmm. as if this was her plan all along. This is what she wanted to do. It's like she's like the rock concert fairy.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go. Go see the Ramones. It was wonderful. And then, of course, the film has to put a number of things in her path,
right,
that she has to overcome so that she can actually get to the concert. Which brings us to another great character, which is the new principal, played by Mary Warnoff.
Miss Evelyn Togar.
And I'm a huge Mary Warnoff fan.
Yes.
We could talk about the movies that she's been in. Eating Raoul. I think I probably saw her first in Eating Raoul. And, Night of the Comet.
Night of the Comet. This was the first thing I remember seeing her. And there may have been something before that. I know she did some TV stuff that's possibly I saw before, but this was the first thing I really remember her being in. And then after that, of course, there was Death Race 2000.
Yeah, yeah.
Hollywood Boulevard. I mean, the list is...
endless.
Endless. It really is.
But Mary Warnoff is always great. She's a lot of fun playing a villain because she's a really good screen actress, and therefore she has this wonderful ability to, even when the camera isn't helping her by positioning itself at an interesting angle, she almost always seems to be looking down her nose at the people she's mm-hmm. disapproving of, and she's naturally funny. She never cracks a joke, and the moments in this film when her character is saying something that's really funny, she doesn't think it's funny. And of course that's the beautiful part of a character like that, which is that they don't realize how ridiculous they're being.
Yeah, she is the joke. She's not in on the joke.
Yeah, exactly. She can't be in on the joke. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But I don't know how you're going to answer this question. But for me, my favorite character isn't either of them. And it's not even Paul Bartel, who's wonderful in this as well. His mm-hmm. his smaller role. My favorite character, I swear to God, is Clint Howard.
Clint Howard. I knew that's where we were going.
Okay, good. In that plot synopsis, the thing I just read off there doesn't even mention his character and the bizarre character that he plays, and the fact that Clint Howard's even in the movie. But Clint Howard is a riot in this film, and when what was so funny is it had been so long since I'd seen the movie, when I went back and just rewatched it last month, I'd forgotten Clint Howard was in it until I see his name in the credits. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, Clint Howard's in this thing. And then as it goes along and we get to the scene that introduces him, and we have him talking to this one character who's really interested in essentially trying to get a particular guy to be interested in her. And I thought, oh, okay, well, he's going to do this, and it's going to be like a cameo role. It's going to be a very short thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. The Clint Howard character, that little subplot, plays itself out over the course of the entire film. And every time that character came back and continued to be this kind of life coach for these two people who he's trying to make hook up romantically, I was in heaven. I mean, that could have been its own little mini movie, and I'd have been just thrilled, you know.
And you almost wish there had been another, the Eaglebauer Chronicles.
Yeah, know. Yeah. The character's name is Eaglebauer. I forgot. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, he's wonderful. And one of the great things, again, about his character is on the surface, he's this hustler in the school who's, you know, trying to, you know, the guy who you think maybe he'd be selling pot or selling test managers. But instead, he's entirely motivated to do good things for people through this movie. And
it's bizarre.
It's really strange. And at the end of it, everything works out. And it looks like his plan all along worked.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there were numerous roadblocks in front of him, he's like the angel on the shoulder that made everything happen for good people.
The geeky, ugly little angel.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Clint Howard, but I mean, the strange thing about Clint Howard is you look at his long list of credits, and he's been in so stinking, well, first of all, he's in every movie his brother has ever directed.
Absolutely,
so.
Yeah.
It's like you forget, oh, he's in Apollo 13, and oh wait, he's in every single Ron Howard mm-hmm. film, so yeah. But the long list of credits, and this is just another one of those. And he's so much fun to watch. He's one of those actors that I never get tired of. But I mean, like, Eagle Bauer is my favorite character because he's an unexpected and unnecessary thing in the film. But I can't imagine the movie without him.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like, who's your favorite character? I mean, Riff Randall would be a lot of. I can see that being.
My favorite character of the movie is probably Miss Togar. And
really?
I think that's because of Mary Warnoff's performance. She is just priceless. I mean, every second she's on the screen is just perfection. And this is a movie that's tough to pick a favorite character because all the characters are really good. I mean, the good-looking jock, he's really well-defined, and he turns out to be a really sweet guy.
Yeah, Vincent Patton.
Yeah, he's great. Eagle Bauer, Kate Rambo, that Dae Young plays, is also a great character. But I think Miss Togar, she's got a lot of the best moments in the film, and I love her just from her introduction, and one of the first great moments that she has is at the beginning of the film when Riff's under the credits, when Riff is playing Sheena as a punk rocker,
right.
And the entire school just erupts into chaos. There's this great bit where she's walking down the hall, and she's just kind of, her head is moving back and forth, and she's looking at all this, and you can see the wheels turning. And as she goes, suddenly a frisbee, one flies by her head, and she kind of glances at it. Then another frisbee comes directly at her face, and she does this quick, and it goes right over the top of her head by about half an inch. And it's, I can't figure out how they did that.
But you wonder if it was a happy accident.
It had to be, because they didn't have time to choreograph anything in this movie. But she just steals that entire sequence without a word. And everything she does in this movie is great.
Well, I will say my favorite actress in the movie is probably Mary Warnoff. Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. I think she's wonderful. As much as I love watching PJ Souls in pretty much everything she was ever in, Mary Warnoff has got a screen presence that, I mean, she gets to play the villain, which is, you know, she's essentially the Darth Vader role.
Absolutely.
So it's a lot of fun to see her do her evil thing. It's way more fun than it probably ought to be.
And it helps that, you know, I think she was probably, except maybe for Clint Howard, she was the most experienced actor in the film too. Clint had probably had more under his belt since, I mean, gosh, the kid had been acting since he was a fetus, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
But Mary Warnoff had been at it for a while.
Yeah, I mean, Clint Howard was eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on Andy Griffith's show in the early 60s, for God's sake.
Yep,
so.
and drinking Tranya. You'll relish it.
Yes, that's our first Star Trek reference. Oh, God save us.
Hey, kids, play Spock the Nerd.
Oh, God. I can sense that you're going to out-nerd me tonight. At any rate.
It's 1980. Welcome to Rock and Roll High School.
Rock and Roll High School?
Do you want to stay there?
I am Miss Togar, and I am the new principal of this school. And who are you?
I'm Riff Randall, rock and roller.
The only girl I ever dream about at night is Riff.
I've done more detentions than anyone in the school's history.
Are you a virgin? How about a cheerleader? Nice set of pom-poms.
Term wanted Riff, but Riff wanted to live a rock and roll fantasy to the music of her favorite group. The hottest band this side of the Iron Curtain, the Ramones!
You have managed to upset the entire school with this godforsaken noise.
Things sure have changed since we got kicked out of high school.
Hey, come on, you guys, follow me into the school!
They tried to stop their music, but the kids got wrecked and rocked the school.
Going to storm the building.
Rock and Roll High School, the school where the students rule. Could your school be next?
And one other interesting thing about Eaglebauer, Clint Howard is great in the movie, and it's hard to envision anybody else being that part, but he wasn't the first choice. Originally, Eddie Deason was who they had wanted to play Eaglebauer. And I can see that.
With a much stranger voice.
Yeah. And I can see him actually doing the same part. It would be interesting to see Eddie Deason, who's a complete spaz, in the role of Eaglebauer, who's a pretty cool guy. But I don't think he would have the same heart to it that Clint Howard has. I don't think it would quite come off the same way.
Yeah. Because with Eddie Deason, not that I haven't enjoyed seeing Eddie Deason in other films, but yeah, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm so used to the Eaglebauer we have played by Clint Howard. But I mean, I think it would strike the wrong tone.
Yeah, I don't think it would work as well. Although if Eddie Deason did something different that worked, we might be saying, oh, well, good thing they didn't get Clint Howard. So, but I think they went the right way. I think that worked out pretty well. And along those same lines, the Ramones wasn't the first band that they had talked about. Other bands that have been mentioned, and I hear this from different places, but the three bands that you hear over and over again that they thought about possibly being in the movie would be Devo, Cheap Trick, or Van Halen.
Well, I can definitely see Cheap Trick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even today I could see Cheap Trick. Devo would have been an interesting direction because it would have definitely taken, because that's more, you're moving into the kind of burgeoning new wave movement at that point. So I can kind of see how that would have been interesting. Van Halen would have made it a completely different kind of thing. I mean, don't get me wrong, those first five Van Halen albums are gold in my opinion, but that would have been interesting. I had not heard the Van Halen thing.
Yeah, it would have been interesting, and you could totally see if you put David Lee Roth as the girl, as the singer that Riff is in love with.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That totally works, and one of the great things about the movie, I think, is they got really lucky in that in the Ramones at the time they got this sort of little known punk band that turned out to be one of the greatest bands in history.
Yeah,
and with Van Halen, they would have gotten this little known LA band just starting out. And wind up with a monster there, too.
That's true.
And, Cheap Trick and Devo, to a certain extent as well, they would have been pretty lucky with any of those picks. But I think the Ramones were definitely the right one. Because the one thing that I can't see as much with the other bands is the Ramones are just pretty funny all the way around.
Yeah.
With
true.
Devo, it's hard to say. Again, the Ramones perfect.
The Devo guys, especially at that time, to this day, they have this stage persona that they put on, and I think that would have been kind of a natural for a film.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, it would have definitely changed the tone of the movie. But
yeah, it's hard to say how it would have worked in this film. But again, because the Ramones are so perfect. But it would any of those choices are interesting, and it's sort of fun to kind of imagine how it would have looked in your head, to see Bunny Carlos playing the drums in Riff Randall's backyard.
This is true. Well, I think one of the things that is kind of a secondary thing that I think is really great about the way the film works visually is the way the Ramones present themselves and dress themselves. Torn jeans, t-shirts, kind of ragged out, just whatever. That's kind of the way high school kids dressed anyway, and you can see how that attraction to, musicians who were famous, how that attraction would be there naturally because kids naturally are drawn to people that remind them of themselves that they can aspire to be because, oh, you're famous, and, I dress the same way you do, and it's not a put-on. It's not something they're doing as part of a show. It's not like Kiss getting up there in costumes or anything like this. This is just the way they look, and there's that automatic identification with them that I think is another thing that works really effectively for it being the Ramones.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that because any of the other bands are already larger than life, either through their presence or costuming or both, and the Ramones do just look like
regular
guys who could be at that school hanging out behind the auto shop smoking.
Exactly. So I think that's another thing that works in his favor.
Well, I did want to mention the music in the film as well, which is great from stem to stern, and not just with the Ramones.
Oh, no, there's a lot of good music in it.
Ton of great music, and a lot of it is music that the Alice Cooper song, the Chuck Berry song, but there were a handful of songs that I wanted to kind of single out because they maybe not be as well known to everybody, or I think they're kind of interesting. And the very first song in the film has the most interesting pedigree. It's the Paul McCartney and Wings song, Did We Meet Somewhere Before, which is the sort of the clarinet-based ballad that plays as the film opens. And it's a McCartney song, which is amazing enough when you think about a film this cheap got an unreleased Paul McCartney song. That song's never appeared on a McCartney record to this day.
Whoa, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it hasn't. It was originally written for Heaven Can Wait, and they passed on it or didn't use it, so it was still there, and Alan Arkush knew somebody who knew somebody, and he got it. And the song has never been released on a McCartney record. It's turned up on some bootlegs. Probably the most common one you can find it on is the Cold Cuts collection, which still has, it was almost ready for release and never came out. But for a while, you would actually see the audio from this film pop up on McCartney bootlegs, and you'd have the dialogue over it, and they would just put the little pieces of the music that you could hear on the vinyl record bootlegs.
Wow, I had no idea. Well, I also really had no idea that that the song was recorded for Heaven Can Wait. Mm-hmm. That would explain the use of the clarinet in it,
mm-hmm.
Because that the clarinet factors heavily into that Warren Beatty film.
Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense. Yeah. And the whole, did we meet somewhere before?
Yeah.
And it's all perfect for that film when you hear of it.
That's amazing. I did not know that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's easily the most interesting sort of backstory on a song, but there are two other songs that I think work great in the movie, and they might not be songs that everyone would know. One is the Nick Lowe song, So It Goes, that they play as the club opens for the Ramones show.
Right.
And you see the kids going, just a fantastic song, and
well, it's a Nick Lowe song.
Yeah, and a lot of fantastic songs from Nick Lowe, but that song is great. And the other one was a song that at the time I saw the movie, I didn't know, and it took me a long time to find out who it was. It's the song High School that plays when the school is just, when the kids have taken over, and like they're throwing the Tuesday surprise at the lunch ladies, and they're skateboarding down the hall, and that's High School by the MC5.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That song is great, and I think it needs to be singled out because it's not a song most people are going to know. And
well, that's true. That's true.
And you know, shout out to the MC5. They deserve it. So.
No kidding. Yeah. I mean, quick question: is it possible to actually get the Rock and Roll High School soundtrack? Has it ever been issued on CD?
I don't think that the whole thing has. Now, I might be wrong. I know the Ramones tracks have been issued as bonus tracks on one of the Ramones records.
Road to Ruin. I
think. It's on the Road to Ruin CD. Yeah. Okay. And that was going to be my guess there, but I knew it was in that era. I don't think the actual soundtrack, if it has been released, it's not out there now. It's out of print, definitely. And the original soundtrack only had just a fraction of the songs that are in the movie. It had all the Ramones stuff, and it had, I remember, gosh, now I'm starting to draw a blank. It had, I think, one of the Eno songs on it. It had Come Back Joni by Devo. The Chuck Berry track was on it, the Alice Cooper track, but there's so much in the movie, it would take probably a 4-album set to get all the songs.
Cool.
But I'm sure somebody out there in internet land has compiled a complete soundtrack album.
I would say, yes, that's probably true. I remember painstakingly putting together a bizarre compilation of the strange little bits and pieces of music that were used in Kill Bill 1 and 2 just for my own joys. So I've given up such large-scale, idiotic musical projects that only benefit myself for a short period of time. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's something that bachelors can do. Those lonely nights.
Those lonely nights when one can focus laser sharply onto something that really is insignificant.
Really doesn't matter, but hey, you got to kill the time somehow.
There's got to be some way. We can't look at porn all the time.
That's people. Right.
Just not possible.
Enough with the boobies.
I think I've seen enough pairs of those tonight.
Gosh. Well, I don't know. There's just so much about this movie, just from beginning to end, that I love.
Feel free to just talk about whatever leaps to mind.
All right. Well, if you folks can bear with me, I'm just going to kind of run down a few of the things that I love about Rock and Roll High School.
Okay. Well, that's probably a good thing. Yeah. What are your favorite things about Rock and Roll High School?
Well, almost every scene in Rock and Roll High School has a great little moment, and that's probably the biggest thing I love about Rock and Roll High School is there's something interesting in almost every frame of this thing. The performances by the actors are all great, just from top to bottom.
Yeah, I agree.
And we've mentioned the great cast with, you know, everybody who's in it is great, but there's so many wonderful things. One of my favorite things at the beginning is when Riff turns on Sheena as a punk rocker and the school just erupts into this riot of dancing and fun. And my favorite guy in the whole thing is the guy in Mr. McCree's music class, the geeky guy with the glasses, who stands up and does the absolute geekiest, most spastic dance in history. But by God, he's having a good time.
Oh, my Lord.
I just love that. And I think one reason that the film is so interesting to look at throughout, not only is it directed very well, but Dean Cundey was the director of photography.
Yes, yes. Talking about Dean Cundey for a second is probably a good idea, because he was such an amazing director of photography. I mean, he shot Halloween and, well, most of the early Carpenter films, mm-hmm. The Fog and The Thing. And well, did he shoot The Thing? No, I can't remember. He shot Escape from New York. Mm-hmm. And he's one of those guys who really had an amazing eye. And as soon as I saw his name in the credits watching this, because the last time I watched this 2 decades ago.
Oh, sure. You probably weren't on the lookout for Dean Cundey's work.
I didn't know who the hell. I'm not even sure if I knew what a director of photography did. So, and working on the low budget that he very obviously had for this, he still manages some wonderful, wonderful shots, mm-hmm. beautiful stuff. One of those behind the scenes people that you're glad that you're really glad was there. So.
Yeah, if you see his name in the credits of anything, even if the movie isn't very good, it's going to look nice.
Yeah.
If he had any way to pull anything off, he did. The guy is a genius.
Yep.
And this is another movie where it shows. He didn't have much to work with, and still it's just one interesting shot after another.
Agreed.
Although there were some other interesting people behind the scenes as well, here and there. Another great early scene in the movie is the bit where we need to get Mr. McGree here. So the hall monitor character, one of the two, puts together a paper airplane and launches it out the window. And then there's this long flight of the paper airplane going from room to room and across the schoolyard, and it eventually zips right into Mr. McCree's ear, and he pulls it out and goes, "Ear mail." Which
is Paul Bartel. It's pure genius. I agree, yeah.
But that sequence was directed by one of the Zucker brothers, who went on to direct Airplane.
Wow, really? I didn't know
that. So again, it's like just this little sort of throwaway by probably the third assistant director. And it turns out to be a guy who directed one of the greatest comedies of all time. So
Airplane would definitely be on my list, mm-hmm. that's for sure.
And I apologize, I can't remember which Zucker brother it was, but it was one of them.
I don't know either.
They're those Zucker guys.
One of those guys, who knows.
But, you can't go wrong with these people there. I mean, it's like this perfect storm of talent
everywhere. Well, I mean, talk about one of the things that amazes me is when you look into the director who's named as director, Alan Arkush.
Right.
You look at his work. I mean, he didn't do a lot of feature films. He did a few.
Mm-hmm.
But for the past 25 or so years, he's been primarily doing television and a lot of television. And you look at that. This is in the Corman studio, in the Corman system, you learned how to do everything. And so to see his long, his just huge list of credits on IMDb, he's like, yeah, he went in and learned his craft under Corman. And you can see a director learning his craft in those early films. And this is one of his early films. And of course, you'd have to call him his co-director would be Joe Dante, who's mm-hmm. another one of those guys who, I don't know about you, but Joe Dante is one of my favorite directors of all
time. Absolutely one of my favorite directors of all time. And it's another guy who's, Joe Dante's films create their own world.
Yeah.
And it's the world of Joe Dante. And it's almost a thread that runs from film to film, and it's great.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's, mm-hmm. I was recently in a conversation with somebody who I'm just getting to know their film taste, and I recommended they see Matinee.
Excellent choice, yeah.
And because to me, if you have the least bit of interest in 50s monster movies and kind of 60s monster movies, that kind of world, and you just want to laugh, mm-hmm. and enjoy yourself, watch Matinee. I mean, it's just it's a great film from beginning to end. I mean, any movie with a movie within a movie called Mant.
That's right.
What else are you going to do but
that's
have fun?
It. And I have to agree. If you don't like Matinee, you probably don't need to go any further with Joe Dante.
Yeah, that's kind of the make or break. Just watch Matinee, and if you're cool with that, you're good. Although, honestly, a lot of people, I think maybe you could show them The Burbs. The Burbs mm-hmm. would get a lot of people smiling.
So. I think so, yeah, and again, Joe Dante's another guy. You can throw a dart as his resume, and you're going to find something pretty good most of the time. So
agreed.
He was sort of, again, I guess, a second unit guy, but the one scene that he directed totally on his own was the last scene that they shot, and it's another great one. It's the scene in the gym where the gym teacher leaves, Riff says gym class called on account of boredom and puts in her demo of Rock and Roll High School, and PJ Souls sings it.
Yeah.
And that scene was shot by Joe Dante, and his goal when he shot, because apparently Alan Arkush had, you hear everything from anxiety attack to exhaustion to, Mary Warnoff has said heart attack, but apparently he was so exhausted at the end of the movie, he was hospitalized. And in the Rock and Roll High School Blu-ray, there's actually a picture of him in the hospital in the making of featurette. So that story is true. So he was just worn out. So the last day, Dante came in and took over shooting that sequence, and his goal was to shoot it like a Richard Lester film.
Oh, that's cool.
Which totally, again, makes sense. Lots of very quick shots. They don't always make linear sense, but they're not supposed to.
No.
How did this person get from point A to B? Doesn't matter. It's a Richard Lester musical number.
For those who are unaware of who Richard Lester is, Richard Lester made the two Beatles movies, Help and Hard Day's Night. So if you've ever seen those movies, you'll kind of know what we're talking about.
Right.
Of course, Richard Lester made a lot of great movies, but
that's, those would be the two musical ones that would be referenced there. Probably not thinking of, well, I guess he would have been thinking of Superman 2 at that point anyway.
I was going to reference Superman 3.
Well, I wasn't.
I wasn't either. For the record, Richard Lester also directed two of my favorite films of all time, the 1973-74 version of The Three and the Four Musketeers. So do not allow the ghost of Richard Lester to rise up and destroy me. So.
Right. That's right. Richard Lester did a lot of great stuff. Superman 3,
not one of them.
Yeah, not that was not one of his, but I don't know how much of that we can blame on him either. He didn't write it. So.
Well, you have managed to... you actually managed to get a brief interview with PJ Souls recently at a convention, and you were wise enough to take along a recorder.
I was indeed.
And so I guess what we'll do now is we'll play this brief little interview with PJ Souls, who famous for, like I say, most people who come to see her at any kind of convention are probably there because she was in Halloween.
Usually Halloween at her tables. Honestly, I've met her a couple of times at conventions. This was the only time I was able to actually interview her. I was at one where it was billed as a Rock and Roll High School reunion, and she had a pretty heavy Rock and Roll High School selection of photos.
Cool.
At the convention where I interviewed her, it was a horror convention, and she had one photo from Rock and Roll High School, and then lots from Carrie and Halloween. So she's a smart lady, smart enough to know her audience and who's going to be lining up for her at these things. But very nice woman, was great enough to give us as much time as we wanted, and hope you enjoy.
Cool.
Okay, I think we're good to go. So, how did you find out about Rock and Roll High School to start with? How did you come into being part of the project?
Well, through my agent, you know, obviously they send you up for casting, and I did about four auditions for them. So, but the first time I went up and I read the script, I just said, this role is mine. I will do anything to get this part. So,
oh, great. That was
I was very determined to get that role.
What were your first thoughts when you read the script, your first impressions of it?
Well, for me, it would have been my first lead role to have the whole movie for me as the lead, and so I was very excited because before that I'd done Carrie and Rock and Roll High and Halloween and some television movies, but I'd never, you know, been up for a lead role, and I just knew that I could really play this part. So, and I thought the script was very funny, very zany. Had no idea at the time, you know, the Ramones, they weren't, it just said the band. It never said the Ramones or anything, because they didn't know at the time, because it was originally called Disco High. It wasn't even Rock and Roll High School, so.
Was it still Disco High when you came into it?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's something I would never knew. I thought that the Ramones had been attached to it earlier than that.
No, everything sort of came together all at once, because I think Alan Arkush was trying to hide the fact from Roger Corman that he was going to switch over to being Rock and Roll High School. He was still selling him on the idea of it being Disco High, and I think they were talking to Cheap Trick and other bands, and I think Alan, he knew about the Ramones, and that was his little ace in the hole that he was going to sort of drop that in at the last minute, which he did.
And you provided your own clothes for the movie, is that right?
I did. Once I got the part, well, actually before, even on my probably fourth audition, which is when I finally got the part, and Roger Corman, that was the only time he stuck his head in and heard me read the scene and looked at me and said, make your hair more blonde, you got the part.
Where'd you get those clothes?
Well, it was a store called Fiorucci, and they were in Beverly Hills. They also were in New York. They're no longer, I don't think, but they were only in Beverly Hills for a couple of years, but today it wouldn't be any big deal. It's like Urban Outfitters, mm-hmm. Kitson, all those really hip stores. But back then it was hard to find striped leggings and, really cool clothes. Although the jacket with the musical notes I got at Fred Siegel. Actually had a tug of war with Rod Stewart over that. He wanted it, I wanted it. And I said, no, I had it on hold for 2 weeks because that was $300.
So you and Rod were the same size.
We were the same size and had the same taste. And that would have been a cool jacket for him, but I got it.
Well, in the movie, you had a great chemistry with Dae Young. And I know she came in at the very last minute. How did you guys get that great chemistry so quickly?
I think we just had, similar personalities, maybe. I don't know. To this day, we've done a couple of shows, and we just hit it off, and we're so comfortable with one another. And, for me, I was really... the person that was guiding her to become a better, more enlightened human being by, get out of the chemistry lab, come on, put some cute clothes on, I'll help you get a guy. So it was kind of cool that, I had that role with her. But it's really kind of in reverse. She's got the more hip life. She's an artist, a sculptress, and, she's still actively pursuing acting. So it's kind of funny how we really were switched.
Well, it worked out great. And you guys really seem like best friends on the screen, and a lot of times that doesn't happen. So
that's true. That's true.
I mean, it really worked. And do you have any memories of Paul Bartel?
Just that he was hysterical. He and Mary Warnoff were terrific to have around on the set, and just the sweetest, nicest guy, and just always funny. I mean, everything out of his mouth was funny, even when we weren't shooting. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's, again, great. And Mary, also, I was going to ask if you had any memories of Mary Warnoff.
Well, just, too, that, when I was working on that kind of a film where you have such a, distance between characters, I didn't really want to hang out with her because she was Miss Togart
right.
to me. So, but there were moments, that we were having fun. I think she was finding it hard to find her place in that role, but she did a great job.
Really?
I love Miss Togar.
Yeah. Yeah, she's fantastic in it. You would never know that.
Yeah. She wasn't quite sure. When you play roles like that, you don't want to cross the line and go over the top, and so you kind of get nervous about that until you actually see the movie, but mm-hmm. she did a great job.
I think so, too. And how about Alan Arkush as a director? How did you guys get so many things done as quickly as you did? There's always something going on. I mean,
I think, it was really, Alan said, we've got to get everything in one or two takes. So, like that phone booth scene where we pull over and I enter the contest. I mean, he said, we've got to get this in two takes. If we don't get it, we can't use it. So it was get it, use it, or lose it. And it just was kind of made us be better, Wasn't a whole lot of rehearsal time. And we're talking 21 days, and we just literally clip through everything, and I think that amounts to casting and mm-hmm. really knowing your cast, trusting your cast, and everybody coming prepared. That's why the Ramones, we had probably 6 or 7 pages that we had to cut out of the Ramones because we just couldn't get them to say their lines, and the ones that are in there are some flubs, but that makes it endearing. Those are the things that stand out. I think Joey or Dee Dee, somebody calls Mr. McGree Mr. McGloob. It's funny. It's funny. Okay, that'll work.
I know my little brother and I always used to, actually, that was one of our running jokes. Let's go see Mr. McGloob.
Yeah, see? I mean, he just couldn't say Mr. McGree. I think it was Joey. It's like, come on.
Well, what were your first thoughts when you saw the finished product? What did you think of the movie the first time you saw it?
Oh, I thought it was delightful. I really did. And my main goal was to pop off the screen with my wardrobe and my energy. I just wanted to amp up my energy. Back in those days, we didn't have Red Bull or anything like that. We had our own natural energy. And I just remember, especially, it makes it easier, was easier for me, knowing you can only do one or two takes. And, instead of dragging it out take after take. So you can apply that energy and go full force, on the first and second take, and it comes across. And that was my guiding principle. I wanted Riff Randall to just be going 200 miles an hour every time you saw her on screen. So I was glad that I achieved that goal, and I thought it was the most darling movie, and I love the Ramones in it. I thought they came off spectacularly, and the whole thing worked, you know.
Mm-hmm. It definitely did. I guess it may have been part of the speed of the filming, but the performances of all of you guys are so natural, and so they really seem off the cuff and very normal. They don't seem like performances
right.
most of the time.
And what's interesting is most of us were in our 20s, and we were playing high school kids. I actually was 28 at the time, and I said, I'm so happy to get this because it's a lead role, and it'll be my last teenage role. So, you know, from there I then went to Private Benjamin. So I was happy to have that last teenage role, even though I was 28. I think Day was 25, and Vince Van Patten was already 25, so it was kind of funny. And you look at it today, and we look like we're in high school. I'm like, all right.
It works for me.
Cool.
The first time I saw it, I was in high school, and I didn't think, look at the old people. You know, they looked right to me. So. When did you start to realize that the movie was going to sort of stick around and have the impact that it turned out that it has?
You know, it took a really long time. For a long time, you couldn't even find it on VHS. I didn't have a copy for the longest time. I mean, you know, it's really only been in maybe the last 10, certainly the last 5 years with the new releases. And I think some company bought Roger Corman's collection, and now they re-released it, dedicated to Joey and to Johnny, and I think maybe Dee Dee. We did a little behind-the-scenes interview with Dae Young and myself and Vince Van Patten, you know, all these years later. But, you know, when it first came out in theaters, it just didn't have the impact. And as much as Halloween, it was a slow burn, but Halloween, of course, took off. And Rock and Roll High School, like the Ramones career as well, it took a really, really long time for people to recognize. And even still, now... You know, Rock and Roll High School, I think, you know, deserves more than it's been given credit for. And one of these days we'll get there. We're still climbing the mountain, but it's definitely more and more popular.
And it should be. Yeah. I mean, I really think it's just wonderful.
It's just fantastic. And it's only because of these conventions. You know, these are so-called horror conventions, and people come to my table expecting to see me, of course, Carrie and Halloween. Then they see Stripes, and then they go, oh my God, you were Riff Randall. And, and it sort of goes together. And so, you know, now, I'd say now is the time when people are really saying, yes, we saw Rock and High School, we love it. So it's finally getting its due. But we still have a ways to go in terms of the broader picture and the Hollywood community as well. You know.
Good. You know, hopefully it'll get there. I love it. Any parting words you might have for the folks who'll be listening to this?
Enjoy the movies and gabba gabba hey.
Right.
Now
All right. And I wanted to say thanks again to PJ Souls, who was as nice as could possibly be. Really sweet person to talk to. So if you're ever at a convention, go up and say hi to her. Great lady. Really nice. And cannot say enough about how nice it was for her to give us, be so generous with her time. A few other things about the movie that have either jumped out at me or things that I really enjoy. I think the best scene in the movie is the sequence that I mentioned before where the Ramones drive in the car and they're doing something to do, or I just want to have something to do. It's a great sequence. And one interesting thing there is that the guy who's driving the car is Rodney Bingenheimer, who is the legendary DJ in L.A. at K-Rock, K-R-O-Q. Oh, okay. And he really played a big part in the 70s and 80s music scene in Los Angeles. If you've ever, most people haven't because they're hard as hell to find, but he did a lot of Rodney on the Rock compilation LPs that had a lot of early appearances by lots of L.A. bands. The Bangles were one of them, the Minutemen. Played a big part in getting a lot of bands on the radio for the first time, and they kind of gave him his due. He's also a double for Davy Jones back on the Monkees.
Wow,
so,
okay.
Guy had quite a life. Speaking of cameos, another one that jumps out, if you know, is that Alan Arkush is in the movie. He's the ticket taker at the club.
Okay.
Wearing his original Fillmore East shirt that he wore when he worked at the Fillmore.
Okay.
And so he's the guy that says, you can't come in. This guy's stoned. He can't come in. And, and he's also the person who stops the mouse until he sees that the mouse has earmuffs to wear.
Ah, yes, because we, of course, this being a really scattershot comedy with lots and lots of little jokes, we didn't mention the musical experiment that the evil principal conducts where rock and roll music causes mice to explode.
If it gets too loud.
If it gets too loud.
And Mary Warnoff says that the one scene in the movie that she used to get lots of hate mail about was the scene where she picked up the mouse by the tail and put it in the tank, because that's not the way you're supposed to pick up a mouse. And something I think is kind of cool, the mouse was designed and performed by Rob Bottin.
Ah, okay. Special effects genius, Rob Bottin.
One of his earliest, I guess, film credits, and I don't know how many acting roles he had. This and The Fog, maybe, might be about it.
Maybe. I mean, what's? Well, I guess the next, just the next year he would have been responsible for The Howling and The Fog, so yeah.
So he moved up pretty quickly, and he also designed the pinhead that you see in the movie that brings out the Gabba Gabba Hey sign. Yeah. He designed that and continued to make the pinheads for the Ramones for years, the pinhead mask that they would use on stage. And another character that I love in the movie is Screamin' Steve, the DJ.
The DJ, yeah.
He's fantastic, and he's played by the real Don Steele, who also was in quite a few Corman films.
Yep, yep. And he's a face. If you've seen a lot of Corman films, you've seen his face before, that's for sure.
And I love that guy, and
he's a blast in the film. he's the epitome of something that's almost gone these days, which is the I wouldn't call it a drive time DJ, but just a the high energy radio rock and roll DJ who's always at a certain volume and a certain energy level at all times, because he is really selling hit.
And he's actually a DJ that people care about, which is no longer. The days when the local DJ could actually matter and be a celebrity are sadly gone.
Those days are long gone.
They are. Another cameo. Well, first, another great character face that shows up at the end of the movie, of course, Dick Miller.
Oh, of course, yes. He plays the cop. Is he like the chief?
The chief
of police. I love Dick Miller. Talk about a guy with a career. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you want to amaze yourself. Look at his resume.
Well, just look up. Go up to IMDb and type in Walter Paisley.
Yeah, just that.
Just that will get you a long list.
Yeah, Dick Miller, fantastic. And alongside Dick Miller is a cameo that I hadn't spotted ever until I was listening to the commentary track on the Blu-ray. One of the other cops next to Dick Miller is Joe Dante.
I did know that because Dante would occasionally give himself a little bitty cameo.
Just a little tiny cameo. Of course, he and Alan Arkush had worked together for years cutting trailers, and they co-directed Hollywood Boulevard, so that makes sense that he would show up there. But
yeah.
And I think he has one great little face where he's like, I'm ready to go, you know. But he didn't get an Oscar, unfortunately.
No.
And, of course, at the end of the film, one of the legendary stories about the film is that when they blew up the pyro to blow up the school, there was way too much. And it was cold, which caused it to blow a lot more than it was supposed to. So when that pyro went off, it really went off. And you'll see in the film, trees are going up in flames. And something that's really amazing, if you look at it, the flag goes up in flames.
Oh, my Lord, I've forgotten, but you're... Oh, wow.
And that would not happen today.
So, that was not... That wouldn't have even been planned.
Now, I don't think they planned on burning the American flag at the end of the movie. The Ramones were rebellious, but not that rebellious.
Not that rebellious. Johnny they were Ramone, still Americans, for God's sake.
Johnny Ramone would never let you burn a flag.
definitely not.
And, you know, oddly enough, we haven't really talked that much about the Ramones as actors and their performance in the movie.
Okay, flat out, they're the weakest link as far as actors are concerned, but they're still so much fun, it doesn't matter, because they're essentially just playing themselves.
Right, and I was going to say, they're not only the worst actors in the film, but they're also the greatest actors in the film. Because their performances are so bad, they're hilarious.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, just... their deadpan delivery, Joey can't get anything right, and they're just a scream, and every line that they say becomes instantly quotable because of their delivery. Things sure have changed since we got kicked out of high school. Hey, pizza, great, let's dig in.
Well, that's another thing, is that this is one of those great comedies where there are at least 50 hysterical lines that are just that can be taken completely out of context and quoted just for fun's sake, just to make someone laugh, whether they've seen the movie or not. Some of those lines are just funny, period. That to me is one of the signs of a great comedy. It's one of the reasons why there are so many lines in something like The Big Lebowski that you're just never going to ever forget. It's because the line is by itself just funny as hell. You know, and there's so many in this that it's ridiculous. And yeah, I think you're right. Some of them do revolve around the bizarre delivery of the occasional Ramone who's been told to point himself toward a camera and say something.
But I think they do a pretty good job, and, you know, all things considered. And on the other end of things, and I really, we can't let it go without mentioning we mentioned PJ Souls, but Dae Young's performance is also really, really good.
Oh, she's great.
In the movie. She's great. It's her first movie, and she just knocks it out of the park the first time. And when those two get together, the chemistry between the two girls, I mean, on the surface, you think, here's this nerdy science student who spends most of her time in the basement splitting protons. Next to Riff Randall, rock and roller, you would think these girls would never be friends in real life. Yet when they're on the screen together, they're totally best friends in real life, and you totally believe it.
Yeah,
totally.
They really sell it. You're right. They do sell it, which is kind of odd. You're right, because on paper, would these two characters be best friends? But then as soon as you see them interacting, it just seems natural to be. Yes. It seems like it would work. It works.
You don't know what the backstory is, and they don't need to set it up that, somehow this girl was being picked on and Riff came to save her.
We grew up next to each other, and we were best friends. Yeah. We've been best friends since first grade or whatever. They don't even tell us that.
Right, because we don't need it. When those two are together, you automatically can sense they're best friends, and it doesn't even seem like acting.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the film was semi-improvised. The takes were done really quickly. So it was either there was chemistry there or there wasn't. Yeah. And there was chemistry, I think, between all the cast members, but especially between those two. That friendship really works. And in some ways, it's the heart of the film, I think, is the bond that those two girls have. That's the real sort of emotional center of it, is between those two and what happened. You really care a lot about them.
Yeah.
And part of that springs from the fact that when they're together, you really like both of those people.
And that I'm glad you brought up again, because that's one of the things that I was trying to get at earlier when we were talking, is that one of the great things about a comedy that I think works is that you actually like the characters. And you want to see them succeed. You want to see them overcome these obstacles that are in front of them. And the obstacles in most comedies are silly little things. She wants to get to a concert.
Mm-hmm.
But you get so invested in these characters, you like them so much, you actually want to see them. And with each roadblock put in their way, you become that much more invested in them, because you're actually more, you know, you like them more and more because you see them overcome these various obstacles. It's great. And you're right. The characters, without those characters and without the actors willing to play them in a way that makes you feel that way, it wouldn't be nearly as much fun. That's why so many comedies are so disposable and they really don't live on. That's one of the neat things about this is a very rare thing, which is it's a cult movie. And you're right. I think that was it Siskel or Ebert, whichever one.
It may have been both. It may have been a joint decision. It's been, you got to forgive me, it's been 35 years or so since I saw it.
I'm sure that clip's out there on YouTube somewhere. But
I'm sure it is.
Seeing this movie even at that time and saying this is a future cult film, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, one look at this movie and anybody would know that. Just the subject matter alone and the fact that it's not dumbed down. It's not a stupid movie. It's a silly movie, but it's not dumb.
Right. It's actually very, very smart.
Yeah.
And that's sort of one of the sort of things that on the surface, it looks like this movie is dumb. But if you scratch just not even beneath the surface, it's brilliant. It's not dumb at all. And that's what makes a really brilliant comedy is this movie looks dumb, but it's not.
There's
a lot of really
smart.
Great stuff in there. And obviously, we both really like this movie.
Oh, yeah. Love it.
If you like this movie, there are a few others that I think you need to see.
Okay.
First off, you have to see Get Crazy.
Which was another Alan Arkush.
Alan Arkush film. I don't think it was the direct film he did after this. I think Heartbeats might have been next.
I think there may have been two. Yeah, I think there was Heartbeats and then another one. Mm-hmm. And then Get Crazy.
And then he got to do Get Crazy. Get Crazy is not a sequel to Rock and Roll High School, but I think it's in the same universe. It's a universe where the bathroom at a concert hall can be so filthy and so filled with piss that sharks swim in it.
Yes.
It's a bathroom where a giant marijuana cigarette can buy a ticket and go to a show and get smoked during the show. It's a really funny movie. It's not as great as Rock and Roll High School.
But it's a hell of a film.
But it's a great little movie. It's hard to see, but it's out there if you want to use the special antenna that I know some folks use. And I know that it pops up here in Nashville on our cable on demand about once every 6 months. So it
is
out
there. Good.
And it might even be out there as one of those burn-on-demand discs that one of the companies do, but I'm not 100% on that.
It may well be. I would have to do some research. I'm not aware. There's so many things now that are being being released via the kind of burn-on-demand stuff that Warner's and all these
Sony and others have done. If it's not out there, it has been available on VHS. It's pretty easy to. I know you can see it in chunks on YouTube, but I don't really recommend that.
Yeah.
But great movie. If you like Rock and Roll High School, you'll like it too. It's really funny and it's really good. Also, I think Eating Raoul is a film that everybody should see, but especially if you're a fan of this movie. Not as zany as Rock and Roll High School, but it's a great comedy with Paul Bartel and Mary Warnoff.
Oh, that just got a Criterion DVD.
Yes, it did.
So, yeah.
Just in the last couple of weeks as we record this.
I would never have expected a Paul Bartel movie to get the Criterion treatment, but I could say that's a good choice.
I'm hoping it's the first of many.
I can go with that.
I'm hoping that Private Parts is next. Why are you laughing?
No, I'm just
How
thinking.
How dare you, sir?
I'm just saying, if we get a Criterion Private Parts, how far away are we from a Criterion Death Race 2000? So,
why? I think that's an excellent idea, folks at Criterion who are listening to this. In fact, let us pick what you guys do next.
Let me pick five movies for you guys.
Actually, if they've done Eating Raoul, they've let me pick one of them. So,
yeah, that's true.
But seriously, the Blu-ray's beautiful. It's a great movie. The old DVD is a little dicey. They kind of stretch the image a little bit, but even then it's better than nothing. But you need to see Eating Raoul. And one final one is a film called The Mayor of Hollywood, which is about Rodney Bingenheimer, the DJ that we talked about a little earlier. The guy he's still alive, has a very interesting life, and his story is great. But at the same time, there's also a lot that talks about the L.A. music scene in the 70s. So it can sort of set a time and place for where this movie was, as far as where music was and what radio was like then. His career in some ways was not too far away from the Screamin' Steve, as far as the local DJ with a lot of power and a big personality. And it's a good little documentary. So you have a chance, I would check that out as well.
Okay, cool. Well, folks, I guess what we'll do now is kind of wrap this up. Hope everybody, if you've never seen Rock and Roll High School, go see it.
Go see it, absolutely.
And if you've seen Rock and Roll High School, we hope we were able to give you some information because that you may not have had before. But if you've worked your way through all the extras on the recent Blu-ray release, there's probably not much you don't already know about this film. But I guess that'll wrap it up. We'll call it a night here and hope that you enjoyed this half as much as we enjoyed talking about it, in which case you would have enjoyed it one quarter of as much as the cat did.
She's still here, though, although I think she's been strangely quiet. I could give her a goose here if you'd like.
Oh, no. The moment she jumped on the table had me squirming. I was a little concerned. But
she's been very respectful.
Yes, indeed. Thank goodness. This would be the cat Snowbell. For those keeping track at home of what cat I'm in the presence of while recording podcasts, this is Snowbell, and she's a new one for the podcast listeners.
That's right. But she'll be back, because I hope to be back.
Well, thank you. John, I'd like to say thank you once again for doing this.
You're welcome.
And I'll just say I am Rod Barnett.
And I am John Hudson.
And we will see you next time.
That's right. Anytime you need a cult movie podcast, we're in the book under Bloody. Get your filthy paws off that guitar, you.